Welcome to the EduGals podcast. We are your co-hosts, Rachel Johnson
and Katie Atwell. We are here to bring you tips and tricks to help you integrate technology into your classroom.
In this episode, we are diving into a conversation about de-streaming.
Yes, so we are going to talk about some of the current issues with the streaming practices, as well as share out some potential solutions or approaches to de-streaming once it begins in September.
Let's get started. This week, Katie and I are going to tackle the topic of de-streaming because we realized in our episode last week that we talked a little bit about de-streaming, but we never actually circled back to it.
Yes, we definitely ran out of time. So we got so involved in the conversation about, well, probability or possibility of virtual schools becoming permanent that we totally ran out of time to even talk about de-streaming.
Yeah, and it was something that was super important and we did want to circle back to. So we're going to dedicate this whole episode to talking about de-streaming.
So as we get started on this, I just, you know, huge disclaimer here. I know about de-streaming. I know a little bit about de-streaming. I know kind of reasons why I really do support this move. But I don't know practically, like in the classroom wise, how it will all kind of unfold. So today we're just kind of brainstorming and trying to come up with some solutions or some reasons why we really hope teachers will support this movement.
And just to kind of fill all of our listeners in Ontario, what's happening is de-streaming is coming into effect for our secondary schools. So starting next year with grade 9 math, eventually the entire grade 9 program will get de-streamed though.
And I think grade 10 as well.
Yeah. And then streaming will still happen for grades 11 and 12.
And so by streaming, here in Ontario, we do applied and academic as well as essential, which I don't know if that's going to be touched or not in this round. But essentially what it does is it kind of determines the pathway for our students. And so academic students have, you know, that university pathway, which will stay open. Applied students, if you are in applied programming, you have to upgrade courses and whatnot before you could be considered for university. So it kind of closes off a lot of options for our students at a pretty young age when they're still kind of maturing and figuring out who they are. So I think that's part of the motivation. Well, that is the motivation for, you know, getting rid of this practice.
And then it's even tougher for our essential learners. I taught essential last year. And so if they ever wanted to be university bound, then they would then first have to take upgrade courses to take applied and then take upgrade courses to take academic. And, you know, they'd probably get stopped from doing that upgrade course straight to academic because of, I guess, the stigma and the, I don't even know what the right word is, but just what essential programming is.
Yes. And so a lot of times this practice, how do I say this in a, well, maybe I don't say it politically correct. It's quite racist. We tend to target our newcomers, a lot of racialized students, a lot of people who don't learn the way that our white colonial system is set up to teach.
Yeah, and our low socioeconomic students as well, for sure.
Yeah, so it's really kind of the way it's being taught currently with streaming, it really does only benefit a certain population of students. And so we're looking to blow that open, change it up, and find ways to target all of our students and keep their future pathways open.
Okay, Katie, so where do we start the conversation?
Let's start with observations because I'm very frustrated by streaming. And then I feel like if we ended on a solution-based approach, I'm going to have a more positive outlook on it all.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, observations. So I'm going to jump right in because let's be honest, I teach English language learners. And so streaming is something that angers me so much. I see it year after year after year, and it's so unfair to my students. And as much as I advocate, it's like I'm falling on deaf ears. And so a lot of my ELLs, particularly if they're lower on the STEP continuum, so STEP is our like the steps to English proficiency. So if they're earlier on in their journey, so they don't have strong language, they are very, very often streamed into applied programming. And this frustrates me. Just because somebody is new to a country and new to English doesn't mean that they don't have the intelligence or the cognitive ability to be an academic student. And so I understand that it's hard to teach them because you have to differentiate and, you know, target language as well as content. But I also think this is something we should be doing anyhow in every single classroom. So I'm frustrated because as an ESL teacher, I always tell my students, you know, don't give up. You know, you have a goal, you have something you want to be when you grow up, let's go for that. But then it's so quickly squashed. So I'm very frustrated on behalf of my students and as an ESL teacher, because it's so disheartening to see what happens in the classroom.
Yeah, I don't know what to say to that.
Neither do I. I don't know. I don't have a solution. Although de-streaming is the solution. So I'm actually excited about that, because then there's no excuse. You have to teach the students in your classroom. You have to give them the chance to be successful.
Yeah, I think it's a really great opportunity at this time to start talking about our teaching approaches and how we approach teaching in our classroom, because I know the words like universal design for learning or UDL and differentiation, they get thrown around in education so much, but I don't think we're necessarily doing it in our classrooms. And I think having this conversation about de-streaming is a really great sort of place for us to step back and reflect as educators on, are we actually doing this? Are we doing it effectively? And how can we maybe change or adopt our teaching practice to make sure we are being inclusive of all of our students in our classroom? Like, you think about the teaching approaches, right? If you are teaching, like, for example, an academic class, you're probably already in that mindset of, okay, these are academic university-bound students. So what do university-bound students do? They typically attend lectures. And so that's sort of like that traditional type approach that you end up taking for those courses. And then you, or if you're teaching an applied course, for example, you're like, okay, these are college-bound students. So they're the kind of students who need more hands-on types of experiences. So, you know, you might lecture a little less and do more activities, but who's to say those activities don't benefit the academic students as well?
Like, even if you think to a science class, where I learned the most were in the labs. It was the hands-on activities that really allowed me to wrap my head around everything that I was being taught in the classroom, like from a textbook or from the lecture style. So I don't think we should be undervaluing the practical learning that can go with each of the different curriculum areas.
Yeah, and then even just some observations I have from streaming, thinking back to the last school I was in, we even had a pre-IB stream. So it creates this divide in your school, in the culture, in the community of, you know, well, you're in pre-IB, so like you're pretty special, right? And if you're not in pre-IB, then you're lumped into this other like group of students who are still fantastic. But I don't know, I've never liked that disconnect and that feeling of, you know, being in pre-IB is elitist and where you want to be, but you're completely devalued if you're not there.
I know. And then it's almost, if you decide not to go IB, you don't have those peer connections. So you feel like you are so disconnected from the rest of the group that you're now going to be going through school with. And so there's almost a pressure to just keep forging ahead with IB, even though it's not a good fit and you're not doing well, instead of, hey, I know the other students and I don't feel badly. You know, there has to be this acceptance of IB isn't the be all end all. And, you know, many teachers and many people out in the world did not go through IB and are very successful.
Yeah. So just even observing that and thinking about those sort of experiences, like, you can see why de-streaming is so important, right? We need to give every student the opportunity to, if they want to, in grade 11 and 12, to do IB if they want to, if that's the path that they choose for themselves. But if you aren't streamed into that pre-IB in grade 9 and 10, like, there's no chance, or very, very little chance, that you'll be able to get there. And so, yeah, that's why these conversations about de-streaming are so important.
And just back to your lecturing comment, I just want to say, as a 14, 15-year-old going into high school, lecturing, probably not the best way to teach them. Their brains aren't developed enough. Like, they're not at a point where, like, especially a first year or two in high school, where they can really sit and get in that way. So, like, if you want to do a grade 12 university level course and you want to do a bit of lecturing as one of the formats of teaching, I say go for it. But don't make that exclusively how you teach.
Yeah, for sure.
Because even in university, you have tutorials, right? So many courses have tutorials where you're going and you're sitting in small groups and you're talking about it and you're learning in a different format. If you're not allowing for that in your classroom, then you're kind of doing a disservice to your students.
It's funny though. I mean, even our students and our parents, like, they have that preconceived notion if their child is in pre-IB or academic and you as a teacher are not standing at the front of the room and lecturing every single day, you're not teaching them. Ugh. I have run into that so much in my career because it's not the way that I enjoy teaching. I will admit, I've fallen back on it as like my, you know, kind of, oh my God, I don't have time to prep for this. So I could stand up at the front of the room and talk about chemistry until I'm blue in the face, right? If I want to, but I know it's not best for my students. But I have had so much pushback in the past from parents and students. And I don't know. I think now is sort of the time to do this kind of change and to talk about de-streaming and to talk about like best practices going forward and to re-examine the way that we approach our courses. Like, I think COVID has given us, even though COVID sucks, it has given us so much reason to like really kind of step back and reflect on what we're doing.
Yeah. And it's like meeting the kids where they're at. Like, that's a big thing. That's a big takeaway for me, especially as, you know, an ESL teacher, because I can't just forge ahead with my curriculum if they're not at a level where they can take that in. So, you know, I've really learned that you need to meet the kids where they're at, figure out how they learn and find ways to engage them and to keep their learning progressing, because you can't just deliver curriculum that nobody can understand. And so I think that de-streaming is actually a really great opportunity to get us to actually sit down and collaborate with one another and look at our curriculum, you know, talk to the special education team in your school about accommodations and how it works, talk to the ESL team and talk about how, you know, what are recommendations for scaffolding for language? How can you make content accessible for English language learners? Because I'm going to be honest, a lot of what we really encourage is going to help every single one of your students.
I went to this one session at SpringQ and just even like he showed us this really quick tip in YouTube. So if you're, and I like to do this a lot, I like to make instructional videos and I like to keep them short to the point and just kind of focused on like one piece of my content, because that way my students can go back, they can rewatch the videos as many times as they need to. So if they've missed something, you know, during the lecture, they can go back and access it. Whereas if you're doing it live in person, they're not going to be able to do that. Anyway, I'm digressing a little bit and going off on a bit of a rant, but the one tip that I saw from him was just even showing your students how to turn on closed captioning, how to auto-generate those captions in YouTube. And then once you've turned that on and auto-generated the captions, you can go back in and translate them. So you can put them into whatever the student's first language is so that, you know, maybe they're listening to it, but then seeing the captions in their own language. So it's helping them make some connections between language. And I thought that was like a really great tip and something that every teacher should be showing their students at the beginning of a semester.
No, that's super helpful.
I think it's also worthwhile for us to kind of have a conversation, though, about like, how do you deliver information to your students? For example, one form I use is videos, but I had a grade 12 college level chemistry course a couple years ago. And my students really liked the videos. You know, they found them very, very helpful in terms of being able to rewatch and stuff like that. But then I had one student put up her hand, you know, sort of halfway through the course and was like, You know, miss, it would be really, really helpful if you also had the content written out, like a transcript, or if you had, like in YouTube, you can add chapter links. And so she's like, it'd be really useful if you had that. So even just that one comment made me kind of go, okay, video is great, but how do I make this even more accessible to my students? So you could think about things like adding those chapters to your YouTube videos, or even think about different modes of learning. So maybe a video is not best for all of your kids. Maybe you pull the audio from it and create a podcast. So maybe they just want to listen to it. Or maybe you also then provide it as written text so that they could then read it if they prefer to do that.
I think that makes a lot of sense, because then, you know, if you have it in all of these different modes or formats, then you ensure that every single person in your classroom will have a way in which they can access that material in a way that they learn best. And yes, it might be a little bit of work ahead of time for you as a teacher, but I almost feel like you're going to have less work on the back end trying to support all of these students who are in risk. And so you're actually kind of saving yourself work in the end of the day.
I actually have a tip for that. So I did this with a video. I forget which video it was, but I did this a couple weekends ago. I needed to create a transcript from the video. So what I ended up doing is playing my YouTube video in one tab, and then in another tab, I opened up a Google Doc and I just set up the voice typing and turned it on and hit record. And you could see it just typing out all the text. Now, okay, fine, you got to go back in and like add all the punctuation and stuff, but I just hit play and kind of walked away from it and let the tech do the work for me. So there are ways to kind of save time when you're creating multiple different sorts of resources this way.
Yeah, no, there's lots of ways. And I've been using Moat more, actually, when I give comments back to my students when they're working on something.
I love Moat.
And I enabled the transcript. And so what that does is that you speak, it takes a couple minutes to load, but it will automatically provide a transcript of the comment for the students. So I love it because they can actually read it as they're listening to it, or they can just read it, or they can just listen. They have that option. But they actually love it, and I think it's been really helpful.
I love Moat. I recently got accepted into the Moat Ambassador program. So yeah, that's how much I like Moat. It's so good though. Like even the transcripts you can translate into different languages. Again, like how much more accessible is that for students to be able to not only listen, but then also read it maybe in their first language as well.
Yep. Definitely.
Love it.
And so I think it also comes down to, and I know this has been thrown around so many different times as well, but like culturally responsive teaching. And I know that's out there and we hear it and it's a buzzword. And I don't mean to bring it up as a buzzword, but I do mean get to know your students. Use their prior knowledge. Use the lived experiences that they have, because you'd be surprised how many may actually know more about your content area. But it's a hobby, and so they may not connect it right away. But by engaging that, it could make a huge difference in their ability to be successful. Like when I teach history, the sheltered one for ESL, oftentimes students don't have a lot of background knowledge of Canada. And so what I'll do instead, I'll get them to share what happened in their own countries during World War I, World War II, etc., or these time periods. And it's amazing how they like to make the connections between what their experiences are and their learning from their countries and what they're learning about Canada and what happened from our perspective. So it's kind of neat. And this whole idea, like when we're talking about the Indigenous history in Canada, they're like, what's Indigenous? Because many, like if they're from China, like they have such a rich and long history that it's such a foreign concept to them to think about the people that were there before, because they've just always been there for thousands of years. So it's kind
That's
of
cool.
Neat. Yeah, it really opens some good conversations, because then I understand why Indigenous doesn't make sense to them and why, you know, when we're talking about this, they're like, what are you talking about, miss? That doesn't make sense. So really engaging them and figuring out what they have learned and what they know and kind of how they've learned in the past, it could really actually benefit everyone.
And I think that that's a great strategy, not even just in a sheltered ESL course,
no.
Right? Like
yep.
Bring it into your classroom. use lived experiences of your students and incorporate it into your course content that way.
You always want to kind of engage them any way that you can with stuff that interests them, because it really does make it more accessible, makes it, they're more motivated.
I think another piece of culturally responsive pedagogy that maybe we should talk about a little bit is the idea of having high expectations and really holding those, you know, positive kind of views that all of your students from any background are able to achieve.
No, I agree. And I think that I understand the frustration for some teachers, but I think that oftentimes our students, if they have IEPs or if they have had, you know, a bad year and so didn't have the best grades the year before, a lot of times teachers will look at some of that and just assume they're just not good students. And so then it becomes easy to kind of just brush it off. But by changing that mindset, I feel like it could actually empower a student and make them feel like they can actually do it, which could end up being a plus instead of, you know, letting them just fend for themselves.
Yeah, I find it really interesting. I feel like my perspectives have changed a lot since I taught Essential last year. You know, great sort of teaching experience in terms of being exposed to trying to meet students where they're at and really kind of engage them in courses. You know, a lot of these sort of ideas come into play there. Like, you really need to get to know the students. You need to be able to meet them where they're at. You need to be able to use their lived experiences when you're teaching them. And then have those high expectations, like especially those kids, they've been kind of shuffled through our system year to year and kind of pushed off in a corner going, you know, oh, they can't do it because of behavior issues or because, you know, maybe they've got like intellectual disabilities or something like that. But, you know, like if you go in with high expectations for those students, like they can achieve.
Yeah. And imagine what that label does to them too. Because if you're told for so long that you're just not going to be very good at this, or we're just going to kind of label you this way and put you into this corner, that isn't good for self-esteem. If you walk into that classroom and you think that every single one of your students can learn and is capable, that's empowering for these students who have been told for so long that they're not.
One of my colleagues is really into kind of the brain science stuff, and I've learned so much from her this year. Like, she's really, really great with that sort of stuff. And what I find really fascinating is she's taught me a lot about, you know, the thoughts that you have will then promote feelings, which then sort of lead into your belief system. So the reason I'm kind of bringing this up here is that constantly having those thoughts about kids, like they can't achieve, or and then those kids having those thoughts of, well, I can't do this, is going to lead to those sort of feelings that are then going to be deeply ingrained into a belief system. And I think it's just even about pointing out, like, okay, you have that thought maybe about a kid, you know, they've got an IEP, they have this disability that's affecting them. And just as an educator, like thinking, okay, I had that thought and they can't achieve, but then stopping yourself and asking yourself, like, okay, that's one thought, but what other thought can I have about that student? Yes, they've got this and I can help them by doing X, Y, and Z. And so that's going to change our belief system as educators, and it's going to help our students think more positively about themselves too.
Yeah. And I think it's so important.
And just even like being told like that we can choose our thoughts and we can choose which thought we want to go with and really sort of work on what our deep core sort of beliefs are has just been kind of mind-blowing for me this year.
No, I think it's so important. And I'm hoping that many educators will take that mind shift. In one of our systems where we can check student information, you can actually see their achievement from previous years. I almost wish that would be locked for the first month of a course, So first month of a semester, lock it. Don't let them see that mark, because it doesn't matter what their mark is. If they earned a right to sit in your classroom, I want you to teach them as if they're capable of being in your classroom.
I am so glad you brought that up, because yes, I will freely admit I am guilty of this. I will, at the beginning of my course, pull my class list. I'll go into our student information system, and I will actually go down and write what mark they got in the previous course. And looking back on that now, like, yeah, it does affect your perspective of the student as they come in. If they've got like a 50% in the previous course, then your initial thought is, oh, that student didn't really earn their credit. They were given it by their teacher. They probably had like a 48 or something like that, got bumped up to a 50. There's no way in heck they're ever going to be able to achieve in my course. Why are they in the academic stream? They should go down to the applied stream. And then you start, you know, trying to put those wheels into place and get them out of your course as quick as you can. Like, I am guilty of that. I will admit, like, that is a terrible, terrible practice to have. So yes, I like the idea of locking it down and not even knowing, and really getting to know your students first, right? Before you start having those thoughts.
Yes, like, take the first little bit, do some review, get some diagnostic evidence of where your students are at, and then build from there. Like, don't rely on a snapshot in time from a previous year when you have no idea if there were extenuating circumstances. You have no idea what was going on in that student's life. Like, give them a chance to continue and to be successful.
Yeah, you really don't know what happened for that student to get, say, that 50, right? It could have been, maybe it was a death of a loved one, or, you know, financial issues at home, or like, it could be so many reasons.
Yeah. Like, maybe it's just the way the course was taught too. Like, I hate to say it, but some teachers do lecture style and some students don't get that. So maybe it's like a personality teaching style, which prevented them from doing better.
I was going to bring that up too, because if you look at even John Hattie's research, right, about the different factors that really kind of play into student achievement, one of them is building that relationship with students. And so if a student doesn't feel connected to their teacher, they're not going to achieve as well. And of course, and I've even like experienced that and lived that as a student myself, I don't do as well in courses where I don't connect with the teacher.
I actually had one course in my high school career where I struggled with it, and I would ask for help, and the response would just be, well, this course isn't really for girls anyhow. And I was like, what? It was a physics course. And this teacher had this mentality that it just wasn't, it's not really for girls. It's more of a man course or a boys course. And I was just like, are you kidding me? Like, this is a science course. Like, what's your problem? And so that, it was a tough semester because I couldn't take him seriously. I couldn't ask for help because he made me feel small. And I just hated it. I hated that course. And so any other, like any time I would ever talk about physics or have to take a physics course after that, it was like dread. It was like I couldn't wrap my head around being open to learning because I felt like I didn't belong.
I'm sorry you had to experience that.
Yeah. The only time, thankfully, like all of my other teachers were great.
I've experienced a lot of gender discrimination in the sciences. It's part of the reason why I have a PhD in biochemistry, but I am not in research. I am not in higher ed academia. I just couldn't take it anymore. And yeah, okay, fine. I could have kept fighting, but I was just tired of fighting.
And so I think that ties in well to our racialized students. They're tired of fighting to fit into a system that isn't working. They're tired of advocating for themselves. They're tired of pushing to make people know that they belong. And so they give in.
And it's honestly like bringing tears to my eyes thinking about it.
Yeah, I see them grow tired every day when they're trying these courses and they're being told they're not good enough. And they're being moved to applied, or they're being moved to courses that somebody else has determined is more appropriate.
Yeah, because as a female in science, like I just chose to walk away and I don't have to kind of deal with that anymore. But you can't walk away from your skin color.
No, and you shouldn't have to. And therein lies the problem of streaming. So it's good to know that there is a solution on the horizon. My fear right now is that people won't take it seriously enough and won't do the learning to make it meaningful.
I have the exact same fear, especially thinking about the traditional, like they're starting with math. I think they're starting with math for a reason. Like there's a really good reason there. But that's probably the toughest crowd to really get on board with de-streaming. So it's going to be a challenging year next year for sure. And there's going to be a lot of pushback.
Oh, totally. And I think that there really needs to be some targeted staffing when putting together a timetable for those grade 9 students.
Absolutely.
And partnerships. Like I said, partner up with your ESL lead if you have one, partner up with SPED lead or department head. Like make sure you're partnering up with these people because they know how to accommodate and scaffold. Use them.
Honestly too, like one of my recommendations would be if you don't have your qualifications in SPED or ESL, go get them. Do that learning this summer because you know, I think there's a lot of fear out there, especially in Ontario, right? You always hear people say, okay, if I've got SPED on my ticket, then I am going to be forced to teach SPED for the rest of my life. Completely not true. In fact, I have had to fight to get SPED sections and had to really, really fight to get in there. So you're not going to be placed in anything that you don't want to teach. But the strategies you learn from that SPED Part 1 course are just so beneficial to all of your kids. I have to say that out of all of the additional qualifications I have taken, that has been the best one.
Yeah, and that goes for ESL Part 1 too, because they really break down how to scaffold for learners at different levels of language. There's a lot to be learned about differentiation that translates into every single course. So I've done both, obviously. So between the special education and the ESL Part 1s, I think that you are going to learn so much. And if you're so worried, you could remove that as one of your teachables or the courses you're willing to teach and still take in that learning for practical reasons. So I honestly encourage it. It's totally worth it. And I think that either of those courses will make you a better educator overall.
And I haven't taken my ESL Part 1, so I think I know what I'm doing over the summer now.
Oh, I love it.
I can't give the advice if I don't take it myself, right?
Yes. And I'm not going to lie. ESL and science, it's an amazing combination because there is so much language, right? And so just learning how to scaffold language in your science classroom, it's going to be good for all students.
Yeah.
Sorry. I shall get off of my pedestal now.
It's okay. You can stay up on your pedestal for a bit longer.
That's awesome. But yeah, so I think that now maybe we can touch upon some of the resources that are out there and available. Here in Ontario, Toronto District School Board has been de-streaming for quite some time. I'm not sure how long.
I'm not either, but I know that they put a pilot project into place, like I think a couple years ago, and they've been de-streaming for quite some time. Yeah, they've got some really useful resources.
Yeah, so what we will be sure to do is to share some of those on our website in our show notes, and those can be found at edugals.com/48. That's edugals.com/48.
So the first resource from TDSB that I came across on Twitter, I would say last week sometime, is they put together this de-streaming choice board. And I think if you really want to kind of start digging into what de-streaming is all about and learning a bit more, there's some really cool resources on here. I have not dived into them all yet, so I think I'll just kind of put that disclaimer out there. I did, though, go into the academic streaming blog by Jason Toe. I hope I'm saying it the right way. If I'm not, I really, really apologize, but he's got a series of 3 blog posts and they are great. It talks about the whys of de-streaming. It talks about his experience in terms of, you know, he used to be a streamer, but his mind has changed. And then it also, the third post goes into some ways that you can start thinking about de-streaming and how to go about supporting all of the students in your courses.
Now, before we move on, you said something interesting and it made me think of something. So you said that he used to be a streamer and now he's changed. I think most educators, when they first start off, are streamers. And I wonder if that goes back to maybe fixes we need in teachers' colleges. teacher education programs. Because if we come out of teachers college thinking streaming is that way, maybe we need to make a change at that level as well to make teachers more open to this concept of all students have ability and not to separate into the streaming kind of mentality.
I think those changes will happen though, in terms of like it'll happen sort of naturally and organically as our curriculum changes. So in terms of like de-streaming grade 9 math now, you're going to have new curriculum that goes along with that. So that will start getting taught in those teacher education programs. And so I think some of those conversations are going to start to come up naturally as we go through this process.
No, I think you're right. And I do think it's going to come. I just hope that they really focus, because I know I remember back in teachers college, I don't want to sound disrespectful, but I felt it was like you're at university for so long. And so teachers college was kind of like the dumbing down year, like to get your mind to shift away from this academic university level way of thinking to make it more like approachable. Does that sound disrespectful? I don't mean to be.
Yeah, I don't know if I would quite call it that.
Yeah, I just feel like it's a way to like simplify, to stop thinking at this higher level that you're so used to thinking at, and to start simplifying the way that you speak and the way that you approach things, because we're teaching teenagers. We're not university level anymore. Does that make sense? Maybe that's a better way of saying that. Not necessarily dumbing down, but like simplifying it. Stop thinking that you need to speak and read and write at such a high level.
The problem is we've gone through the system, right? And anyone who's a teacher and an educator has gone through the academic pathway and the university-bound pathway. And so that is part of the problem.
I know, because that's the way that we learned and that's our experiences.
Can you imagine? I would imagine like some of the best people who would be teachers out there are ones who have not gone through that pathway because they have lived the experience.
Yeah, totally. And they have a different perspective and something else to share, like something that works for them that may work for a bunch of our learners.
And even some of the best educators even now are ones that maybe didn't get like great grades through university bound because that's not the way that they needed to learn. But eventually they kind of fought their way to that pathway because they wanted to change the system. And so, yeah. Anyway, I don't know. I'm going off on a tangent. But.
Yeah, I guess the point I was trying to make is that the whole de-streaming conversation, we do need to start it earlier, but I understand why it's a challenge when we're in teachers college because we're already trying to simplify so much. Although now that it's 2 years, I almost feel like it's perfect. Like, spend the first year, you know, simplifying our thinking more practically about how to teach that information. And then the second year talk, like remove more of some of these racist practices that we have in education and focus more on de-streaming and the thought process behind it and UDL and how we can really differentiate and teach all people.
So I don't mean to pick on my teacher's college experience either, but I think part of the issue there, right, is I remember having this one assignment where we had to videotape ourselves teaching a lesson. Again, we're promoting that sort of teaching method of lecturing. It's almost like it got ingrained in there. Like you go through all of your education learning from that style, and then you go to teachers college and you get these assignments that are also geared towards lecturing. That, of course, you end up doing that when you get out of teachers college.
Okay. And it is important to learn how to lesson plan, but we still do it now with TPA, so teacher performance appraisals. Formal lesson plans, I think we need to ditch them. And I say that because when I'm in front of my students, if I have a lesson plan that I have, you know, put together, I'm not going to stick with it if it sucks. If I find my students aren't learning, I need to be able to flip out of that and switch to something else. And so it's great to have like a plan, but I don't think it needs to be as detailed as what a lot of TPAs or teacher colleges, etc., are requiring of students. Like there needs to be more flexibility and some more recognition of the fact that I can have an idea in my head, of how I want to structure it. And I can put it out on paper, but I need to keep it flexible enough that I feel comfortable going off topic or off-roading, so to speak, and not following that plan.
I think you brought up a good point there. The mindset of administrators needs to change too. And that whole TPA process.
Oh.
I was listening to an episode of the Modern Classrooms Project podcast over the past couple days, and they were doing like a Q&A style podcast, and even the questions that they were getting. So they're very much blended instruction, self-pacing structures, mastery-based grading. And they were getting questions from educators about how do I prepare my admin coming in to do my TPA for what they're going to see? Because they're not going to see me standing at the front of the room lecturing. And there were two or three kind of variations on that question in the episode. So it's really kind of interesting that we've gone down this road talking about this, because I think the mindsets of even administrators about what they see in a classroom and what constitutes good teaching needs to change too.
Yes, because I think that feeds into this whole lecture style, this whole streaming and not considering all of our learners. I think it needs to change. The whole process needs to change so that it's more flexible and it doesn't have to be teacher-centered. It's more about what my students are doing and what they're learning and how I've structured it so that they're able to.
That was actually their best advice too, is to prepare your admin to not focus on what you're doing in the classroom, but to go and talk to the students and ask them what they're doing.
That's really funny. I like that. It's nice to know I'm not alone in my thinking, though, because sometimes I feel like I'm way out in left field.
All right. What other resources are we sharing?
So we have a podcast that is all about grade 9 de-streaming by Noah Daniel. And so, Jason, I think we've committed to toe. I apologize, Jason, if that is incorrect and you are listening. Amanda Potts, Melanie White, and Brian W. There's a great podcast that they have where they talk all about potential as well as challenges with de-streaming. And so we will be sure to include a link to that podcast as well. And that was released by Ontario On Ed Mentors, which I'm guessing is Ontario Education Mentors podcast.
So I think on that note, we're going to wrap up our conversation here. If we come across any other resources, we'll also put those in our show notes along with the ones that we've mentioned in our episode today. So you can find our show notes for this episode at edugals.com/48. That's edugals.com/48.
And if you think that a friend or colleague may benefit from this episode, please be sure to share. And make sure that you have subscribed on your favorite podcast app so that you don't miss out on any future content.
And if you'd like to weigh in on the conversation about de-streaming, you know, maybe you've got some advice on how to support all of your students, or you've already been de-streaming and what your experiences are, we would love to hear them. So you could go onto our Flipgrid at edugals.com/flipgrid and leave us a video message there. Or you can go onto our website and leave us a comment at edugals.com.
Thanks for listening and see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of our EduGals podcast. Show notes for this episode are available at edugals.com. That's edugals.com. We'd also love to hear your feedback, so leave us a message on our website.
And if you enjoyed what you heard, please subscribe and consider leaving a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. Until next time, keep being awesome and try something new.